Kalokatawanto, Kierkamla Dateline from RNZ Pacific, Nukoroi Hawkins, coming up.
It's a bit ridiculous, really. I mean, I've yet to see the formal motion.
A Samoa opposition MP calls the Prime Minister's accusations of treason an election ploy.
We are quite concerned of what is happening in terms of medicine, in terms of medical attention.
The Fiji government is urged to tell the truth ahead of its budget announcement, and
the only reason why we have women in parliament is because they have to have at least 10% women in our parliament.
Strong messages from Pacific feminists this International Women's Day. There's a shadow hanging over next month's election in Samoa after an extraordinary decision by the Prime Minister. Toilaepa Sailele Malelingaoi is setting up a commission of inquiry into allegations of treason and breaches of parliamentary standing orders by four members of the new opposition party, Faatuatua Ile Atua Samoa Watasi, or FAST. The four are former Deputy Prime Minister Fiame Naomi Matafa, Lauli Leotia Polatai Vao Schmidt, Faumuina Wayne Fong, and Olofiti Vaain. Toilaepa was upset because they were campaigning when he says they should have been attending Parliament. Fiame Naomi Matafa spoke with Don Wiseman, who asked what she made of it all.
Well, you know, Parliament's dissolved and, you know, I think it's a bit of an election ploy. Just put some heat into the mix, I suppose.
Does it worry you at all?
No, it's a bit ridiculous, really. I mean, I've yet to see the formal motion. There are a few confusing things in there, especially the fact that the motion is being moved within a parliamentary session that was dissolved sort of like 12 hours later. So, you know, we're not quite sure about the validity of that because usually the business of parliament lapses. And also, commissions of inquiry are usually commissioned by the executive branch, but somehow the PM, through making this motion, is using parliament to process this particular, I don't know, charge or complaint. So, quite frankly, I haven't had a chance to have a look at it. I actually think it's just a political gamemanship, although, you know, the intent might be there. But, you know, when you're talking treason, it usually doesn't go to a commission of inquiry. It usually goes to charges that are put before the court. So I'm not quite sure what that's all about.
The Prime Minister, of course, has got a well-professed dislike of calling commissions of inquiry, hasn't he?
He does.
He wouldn't.
You know, especially when 83 people die.
Yes. He wouldn't call one over the measles epidemic. But he's done this just ahead of the election. Is this an attempt to frustrate your campaigning?
Yes, I think it's also, I think he wants to demonstrate to the Samoan public that he has the powers. You know, he's putting in what is a very unclear sort of charge and a lot of confusion around, you know, which government authorities or laws are being used. So, you know, it's a bit of a mishmash.
I understand there was one issue about you and your opposition colleagues having been away from Parliament for an extended period of time because you were campaigning. But this happened to come through a period where the parliamentary session was being extended and extended.
I mean, if you look at the context of what was happening in Parliament, I mean, it's a travesty. 6 weeks to do a supplementary budget that would usually take 2 days at the most. You know, and speeches were lasting either one speaker a day or one speaker lasting 2 days. And that was usually happening because, one, Parliament might start late. Two, when making interjections, usually the Prime Minister or some other government minister, you know, usually on points of order and points of clarification, they're very short interventions. But they would actually speak for like anything from 10 minutes to half an hour, or in some cases, especially with the PM, he would just go off on a tangent and speak for a whole hour and then would have very long coffee breaks. So it was that sort of thing. And of course, you know, the basic standing orders that when you're making a speech during the debate for the supplementary budget, your time is half an hour. So you can see the kind of nonsense that was going on. So we actually had better things to do. And for the calendar that was given to us, and, you know, hence doing our planning, you know, they just had the 19th of January as the date for the session to start. So we followed due process. We gave in our notices for leave. Not once did we get any response from the speaker to say he didn't agree? And during the meeting, there were various attempts by different members in the House to put up some sort of motion to chastise us, or I don't know. But the speaker always took the line that, you know, that was his prerogative and just to leave it to him. And he even at one point said, look, just let those people do what they're doing and we'll just do what we're doing. So I'm not quite sure whether the speaker knew what was happening. I think he did. But I think quite a lot of other members were a bit surprised.
So do you think it'll all be resolved? Everything will be sorted out well ahead of the April election?
Well, through the terms of reference that I haven't seen, this commission, when it's set up, will have 3 months to do its work and supposedly report back to the clerk of the House. So, I mean, there's still some question, Don, about, you know, the validity of opening a process in a lapsed parliament. So it's going to be interesting, but I think we do need to have a look at it. But more importantly, it will be good to see how the process unfolds once he gets his commission in place. With the makeup of the commission, a retired judge, so there's a small pool of those people, and some of those people aren't here. The newly appointed ombudswoman, she's currently away, so with COVID, I'm not sure how quickly she'll be able to come back. And then the third member, I think, is a senior independent lawyer. The mechanics of that has to be set up, and I don't imagine, given the way it was very quickly pulled together, that it was something that was well prepared and so forth. And just on the hearing of the motion being read out, you know, I didn't think it was a very cohesive preparation. We'll just have to see. And I wish I could be more clear with you, but I haven't actually cited the actual motion.
That was Samoa Opposition MP Fiame Naomi Matafa. Civil society groups in Fiji are calling on the government to come clean and tell the people the truth about the state of the economy. This comes amid public consultations on the highly anticipated 21-2022 national budget, which is expected to be delivered this Friday. The COVID Alliance for Humanitarian Response says there is a lot of uncertainty about the state of the economy and the future direction being taken by the government. The Alliance says with several major cyclones also striking Fiji during the past year of the pandemic, the government should own up if it does not have the money to help Fijians. Christine Rovoy reports.
Last July, the government unveiled the largest ever $1.7 billion US budget for the 2020-2021 financial year. In delivering it to Parliament, the Minister for Economy, Ayaz Sayyed Kayyum, also announced a $930 million US stimulus package to fund the government's recovery from the impact of COVID-19. Addressing last week's virtual public consultation on the 2021-2022 budget from Singapore, Sayyed Kayyum said the government had borrowed $1.4 billion, of which $690 million was sourced offshore, while the rest, $454 million, is from the National Provident Fund. Mr. Sayyed Kayyum said the gross borrowing is to pay for operating expenditure due to less revenue and the economy contracting.
Are we borrowing money to build things that's no use to us? We're borrowing money to spend on operating expenditure. Are we borrowing money just to pay for government expenses or civil service pay, etc.? We have not done that. We have not borrowed money to pay for operating expenditure. But this year, for the first time, we are actually borrowing to pay for operating expenditure because we have less revenue and our economy is contracted.
But the leader of the opposition Unity Party and former treasurer Savinatha Narumbe says stabilizing revenue and removing wasteful expenses must be the first priority of any government in a crisis. However, he says the government has done exactly the opposite by destabilizing the revenue further.
Fiji is simply borrowing. Full stop. Government is borrowing more so the future generations could borrow less. This is simply nonsense, economic nonsense. The only reason why the future generation would borrow less is because they would have to seriously cut expenses in order to have enough money to repay the debt.
Fiji has had more than 60 cases of COVID-19 with 2 deaths so far. 1 year into the pandemic, thousands of Fijians, majority of them in the tourism sector, are still without work or are on reduced hours because the border remains closed. Shamima Ali of the COVID Alliance for Humanitarian Response claims state assistance is not reaching people who have lost their jobs and families who have nothing to eat.
we are quite concerned of what is happening in terms of medicine, in terms of medical attention, in terms of food on the table, you know, the job losses, the pay cuts and so on. People are, and education, you know, how many kids are not in school. So we are not getting a clear picture from the government, but on the ground, where the picture is getting clearer and clearer.
The head of the European Union in the Pacific, Sujiro Sim, launched the Citizens' Budget Guide in Suva last week and called on the government to prioritise health in the budget. Ambassador Sim says money must be spent to safeguard the Fijian people from COVID-19 because of the impact the pandemic has had on jobs and the 40% dent it has placed on government revenue.
Citizens must be involved in the elaboration and in the execution of the budget according to the principles of transparency and accountability, which are really about saying what you do and doing what you say. I call for everyone to work in partnership because whatever we do, we do it better if we do it together.
Syed Kayyum had earlier told Parliament that last year's budget deficit was steep at 20.2%, which pushed the debt to GDP ratio to 83.4%. But he said the cost of doing nothing was far steeper.
Together, we can build a more liberal economy, an inclusive, fair and just society, supported by a more streamlined system of revenue collection that lends ease and transparency to businesses, creates and sustains jobs whilst eliminating loopholes that all too often lead to corruption. We can broaden our economic foundation.
The government has projected that its total debt will increase to $4.1 billion by July this year, with gross borrowing for the 2020-2021 financial year at $1.4 billion. According to a report by the Citizens' Budget Guide, the government's expenditure for 2020-2021 has increased by around $69 million. The report said the expenditure was higher than the COVID-19 response budget. The EU-funded report was developed by the Fiji Council of Social Services with the support of the United Nations Development Programme and the Pacific Islands Association of NGOs. Nayadangu, Christine Ravoy.
Pacific feminists have delivered strong messages for International Women's Day this year. During the COVID-19 pandemic, domestic violence soared globally, and the Pacific, which has some of the world's highest rates of violence against women, was no exception. To mark International Women's Day today, Sailor Jane Hopgood spoke with five Pacific women about tackling gender-based violence and gender inequality in the region.
Samoan feminist Malusel Doris Tulifau is using her non-governmental organization called Brown Girl Woke to empower young girls in primary schools in rural areas. Malusel initially started the initiative in the US while she was in college. Years later, she decided to explore her own personal journey as a domestic violence survivor by moving to Samoa and looking into the statistics of domestic violence in her homeland.
As much as there is data here, there still hasn't been a solution. So I found myself bringing my organization here from America and start making those safe spaces for young people, especially this next generation, who should be the solution now.
Malusel says to address gender inequality, every generation of women have to keep opening doors for each other and passing on the torch to the next generation.
It is hard here in a country that's very patriarchal. You feel that no one helped you and you don't help the next person. When I come into these spaces, I'm reminded that I don't want that to happen to the next young woman. I want to make sure that the doors that I open will be easy for her to go into those doors.
Fijian women's activist Roshika Dell says her idea for tackling gender-based violence is to target the school system and ensure young students have a comprehensive education on sexuality. Ms. Dale says that includes not only the physical act of sex, but learning about sexual reproductive health, human rights, empathy, equality, and so forth.
These are the information that helps us, you know, develop that kind of empathy, that kind of, you know, dignity, integrity, and autonomy around our bodies and our rights. And that's what a comprehensive sex education is. It's not only about sex.
Ms. Dale says research has proven that informing young people on a rights-based sex education will lead to a reduction in gender-based violence.
If we are consistently relaying strong, powerful messages of equality between men, between women, between gender non-conforming people, if we instill values of non-stereotype gender roles and educate our kids about respecting and what consent means in relationships, we're actually addressing many of the underlying inequalities that result in gender-based violence.
Juliana Zutu from the Solomon Islands is a SafeNet coordinator with the Ministry of Women, Youth, Children and Family Affairs. Ms. Zutu says it's important to advise parents to get involved in their daughters' education as it'll not only benefit them, but also make their families, communities and the country safer and more prosperous.
Education is very important because it will give them knowledge, skills, so that when they face any challenges in their work as a women leader, they know how to deal with, address and also help the community.
Ms. Zutu says she's seen a positive change in young girls through education in the Solomon Islands, with data showing that there are more females registered in high school than males.
We've seen in some of the male jobs in Solomon Islands, like engineering, electrician, carpentry, information technology, we have seen quite a good number of females in that job.
Fijian feminist Jana Elitreo has added to the conversation, saying a lot of change would come from changes to Fiji's legislation. Meanwhile, Fijian politician Leonora Giregiritambua says any gender equality education needs to start early to set the foundation for our young women. Ko Sela Jane Hope, good TNA.
Vinaka Sela, that was Dateline from RNZ Pacific. There's more on our website, rnzi.com, and you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, Lukim Yufala.